When Srini suggested that I speak about breaking waves here, I told him, well, it doesn't have too much to do with your subject, but he thought it would be of interest. I'm a little heartened by Anatole's suggestion of the wave-like nature of turbulence, however. I'm using this machine because at the end of my talk, I want to show you some animations of simulations, numerical simulations, and I have to use that. It's the first time I've ever attempted this. Let's see if I can get something up here. I want to show you the first picture is to remind us of the ancient and symbiotic relationship between man and the air-sea interface. Must be some turbulence there. You see the man, this is, we reckon to be, I've heard bigger figures, but maybe 50 feet high. You can have the next one. And this relationship has altered man's life, and it's altered the lives of all of us. If you think that globalization is a product of the computer, then try to transport a Toyota from Yokohama to Long Beach on the internet, and cheap ocean transport changed the world beginning about 100 years ago. I'm going to show you throughout this lecture at times results obtained in a large facility which is on the campus, and it's a wind wave tank. The tank is 180 feet long and 14 feet wide. And here you see some breakers in the tank to show you the scale of the tank. You see there's a wind tunnel connected with the tank so we can generate waves with a wave maker, which is at the far end. You see fans at the top or parts of fans. And this is the largest facility of this kind in the country and probably the best equipped large facility in the world. There are only a few others. Here's a picture of can we turn it off? Yeah. I guess I can just turn this off. No. Here's a picture of a breaking wave taken in that facility, and you can see that this wave, although the waves are essentially planar, that the breaking isn't, and in fact it's progressing from here and spreading out in each direction. So you see a later stage of the splashing, notice this kind of structure, and you see it smaller and smaller over here. This wave is made with a wave maker. It's 2.3 meters in length. And these waves are made with the wind. And notice for each of these small waves, and these are in the range under 1 meter, they're 50, 70 centimeter waves, the dark line at the crest. And this is due to the effects of surface tension and suppressing the jet, which forms in the breaking of all energetic breakers, an energetic breaker being one as shown here at the top. These are from numerical simulations. This is the end result of a modulation process, which I'll talk about a little bit, during which the wave decided to break. It deformed first, and this is the last stage before splashing. surface tension is absent here, and you see the effect. This is for a surface tension of air and water, and you see the effect of surface tension. And we come down to waves under a meter, 50 centimeters and under, a jet does not form. And this has enormous consequences. And in fact, I believe that you would not have waves on the ocean except for the existence of breaking and of jets like that. I perhaps can explicate that rather strange statement later on in this lecture. The jet is very hard to see with the eye, and these are taken with a 1,000-frame camera operating at several hundred frames per second, and you can here we catch the jet. These were taken in the process of doing simultaneous radar scattering and visualization experiments, and I'll return to that. As a result of observations of this kind, we can roughly describe the breaking process in terms of its phases. At some point, a wave which looks like a normal wave and in the ocean has a steepness a little greater than a tenth. The real mystery, well, it's a great mystery why waves of that steepness should break. These are nothing like Stokes limiting waves, and I hope to explain that to you partially. You see the criterion is always already mentioned here, and I'll show you the basis for that. Once this criterion is reached, U is the orbital velocity of the crest of the wave. The wave deforms. The crest and trough both rise. The front face steepens. You saw the product of that in a previous picture. In the absence of surface tension, a jet initiates at the crest. It goes into ballistic trajectory. It plunges, and it hits the front face, resulting in splashing, hard to see with the eye. And at the end of the talk, this is where turbulence is made, and at the end, and vorticity is generated. And at the end of the talk, I'll show you some simulations of that process, which we recently made. The whole thing's over in one wave period. So what is the mechanics of this process? And we've learned a great deal about this why question and also the how question by doing exact numerical simulations. This is a fully nonlinear exact calculation using boundary element method, in which we can drive any shape wave maker with any kind of time history and follow the waves. Here, it's being driven at a carrier frequency and two sidebands, which are in the Benjamin-Fear unstable range. So the sidebands are gaining energy from the beginning, and you see eventually modulations which result from the beating of the sidebands with a carrier wave. And here, if I follow a group, groups form, and if I follow a group, which is shown by the dashed green line, it moves at, in fact, half the speed of the wave, which is following the red dots. The wave, is the crest, is passing through the group at the blue arrows, which is every two periods. So if breaking occurs when the wave goes through the peak of a wave group, which is what does happen, then you would see the wave breaking at a period not of the wave, but of twice the wave. This was already observed many years ago from the air. And it gave substance to the existence of wave groups in the ocean, but it was a casual observation. These are profiles of the waves obtained from the same simulations. They're very high resolution. And here you see the wave has decided to break. It looks rather normal at this point. And you see the increase in the crest, trough, steepening of the front face, the formation of a jet. And here we can follow the jet in the second diagram. As for the criterion, this is obtained by using these simulations as an experiment. And here you have the orbital velocity at the crest at the initiation of the deformation process divided by d omega dk. It's not quite sea over 2 because the wave is slightly nonlinear. But essentially, and all of our data are here, and it includes simulations of deep water, shallow water, and wave-wave interactions, and they all obey this criteria. For every single point here which doesn't reach this dashed line, the wave goes on, recedes. And for every point which reaches it or exceeds it even slightly, the wave goes on to deform and break. We have confirmed this criteria experimentally using a surface particle following measurement. And so we've observed the particle velocities and have confirmed this criteria. I can't say much about the theory to explain this criteria, but perhaps at some time, and if you're interested, I can talk about that. The waves, jets of various intensity are produced from the same initial conditions. This is a weak breaker, and this is a strong breaker. And notice the shape of the front varies. Here it's flatter than here, and this is virtually a parabola. If I fit a parabola through here with the focal point here, would almost go through this region, and this has profound implications for radar scattering at low grazing angle. It's very interesting that in our calculations, which used domain decomposition, allowed us to keep computing after the jet crossed the boundary, and it's very interesting that it doesn't turn off. It keeps running water. Now, energy and momentum are leaving the organized fluid motion. That's extremely important. Energy and momentum are flowing, both potential and kinetic energy, flowing out the top, flowing down in ballistic trajectory. And the relationship, the quantities of momentum and energy which are lost in a breaking event, are very crucial for the dynamics of the ocean, as I'll explain. I'm sorry, I can't hear you quickly. The vorticity is in the interface. There is no vorticity. It's an inviscid flow. There's just air above. It's been known, and it's been a scientific mystery since World War II, when ships began carrying radars, that occasionally, and this was a great pain to a difficulty for the Navy, that very large returns called sea spikes would be observed. By very large, I mean square meters, tens of square meters. In our tank, we have a radar of very high range resolution. There's a range resolution of the order of 3 centimeters. That means that we can synchronize the return signal, we're looking down at a 60-degree grading angle, with our observations. And we've done that here. This is the plunging phase. I showed you a high-speed movie of that phase. And the high return, you see black is the highest return, occurs in the plunging phase. And the reason for that, which is discussed in a paper which was recently published, is that the concave front face focuses a lot of energy, incident energy, in front of the crest, and the jet goes through. It's an incredible happening, but it explains that scientific mystery. The fact that breakers can be visualized in this way is very useful for studying ocean dynamics. And this is a range time diagram. The radar's on a cliff, and the waves are moving toward the radar. So you see as the range reduces, time is increasing. And you can see lines inclined at a certain angle. And those lines are defined by little black spots. Those black spots are 2 wave periods apart. And the lines are inclined not at the phase speed of the wave, but at the group velocity. And I saw this some years ago, and it's the first evidence of that breaking is responsible for the sea spike, and I mean definite proof. It's a historic picture. So we can use radar at low grazing angles to see, you see wave groups here, because you see multiple lines, parallel lines, and that means that there are wave groups in the ocean, they're not stochastic events. The question as to whether wave groups exist in the ocean, which are of course nonlinear events, has been very controversial among oceanographers. Increasingly less so, they're more willing to accept their existence as we find evidence of this kind. And here is another bit of evidence which goes toward explaining this why question and explaining the low steepnesses. Within this shaded boundary are data obtained in our tank from experiments, three-wave experiments, just like the simulation, the carrier wave and two side bands. And we could observe the growth rate of the sideband systems. And this is the line, solid line, is from using a calculation using the Krasitsky dynamic equations. That's the line of most rapid growth. The parameters here are the steepness of the wave, AK, and the sideband spacing. These are vertical lines are experimental regions of fastest growth, which coincide pretty well with the Krasitsky prediction. Outside of the shaded line, we didn't find breaking. And we did a lot of fully nonlinear numerical calculations in this region to find this lower boundary. So we've defined it pretty well. And you see it's at about 1/10. So my guess is that the breaking of ocean waves, which takes place at steepnesses, I'm talking about energetic waves, a little greater than 1/10 is probably right here. It coincides with the intersection of the fastest growing instabilities. The instabilities and breaking are related, as I explained through the simulation. It's the modulations which lead to breaking in that criterion. And the theory for that I've done, but I haven't published. Now, one of the most profound facts about ocean wave dynamics is contained in two plots, which this is the first. They're called fetch plots. And here's the non-dimensional energy and the non-dimensional fetch. The picture is a shoreline, a straight shoreline with the wind blowing out to sea. Buoys are put out, and the energy, the amplitude of the waves is measured as a function of distance offshore. The non-dimensionalizing independent variables are U star, or the wind speed, and G. That's all. And the data group quite well, and this has been known since World War II. These are from the laboratory, and this is full scale. It's not surprising that the energy grows with distance offshore. We're used to the fact that wind can blow up waves, although we took it for granted, and that I'm going to talk about it. Now, this is more remarkable. This is the frequency at the peak of this narrow spectrum. At each buoy, we measure a narrow spectrum of wave energy. The peak is downshifting. It's moving as we go further offshore. The peak is moving to lower frequencies, faster waves. Obviously, nonlinear process at work. This has been explained only in the last 10, 15 years by invoking nonlinear wave-wave interactions, the four-wave interaction. The problem with that is that energy can flow to higher frequencies as well as lower frequencies. So what controls the direction in which the downshifting is occurring? And the fact is that I think nonlinear conservative theory cannot in itself explain this downshifting, although it's been used, kind of fudged actually, to do so. All numerical codes out there use nonlinear wave-wave interaction. So what controls the direction in which energy flows due to nonlinear wave-wave interaction? We know from experiments that braking is absolutely crucial in determining change of frequency. Here's an experiment in our tank, logarithmic scale, linear scale, carrier wave with two side vents. You see that recurrence occurs. No braking has occurred between out to 41 meters. The slope, the steepnesses weren't large enough. And here you can see interesting things if you study these plots. Every one of these peaks, field is totally quantized in a way, and every one of these spikes can be identified in terms of wave-wave interactions. As soon as braking takes place, permanent downshifting occurs. And here you see a simpler plot, but that tells the story. You see this downshifting of the spectral peak is permanent. And we've observed as many as 6 or 7 of these shifts from this frequency and so forth and so on. Now, it isn't only dissipation which is responsible for the direction in which the energy flows. And in order to understand that, we've modified, here we have a theory for the evolution of waves based on Widom's theory. Widom's theory was totally conservative, so there were zeros on this side. But we want to understand the impact of forces on the surface. That would be the wind pressure due to wind blowing over the surface and the fluxes of momentum and energy through the jets on the surface. And we can, in an entirely rigorous way, undertake this theory. This is a work function. This is the energy flux, and this is, including the minus sign, is the thrust acting on the surface from those two sources. This is Widom's mechanics, and actually, as I've given it in a simplified form. The important thing here is that I've included momentum conservation law as well as the energy conservation law. And when we're dealing with non-conservative systems, that's essential. The other important thing is that I can replace momentum by the wave speed through this exact relationship. And then we have what is in effect a conservation law. It's a combination of energy and momentum, but together with energy defines the system in this form. This is an exact result for a narrow-banded system. The double underline term involves derivatives of the Lagrangian, is responsible for instability, modulations, recurrence, etc. The single underline term, which comes from the work on the surface, is responsible for downshifting, long-term downshifting. This term is quasi-periodic, and it isn't responsible for downshifting. If that term is positive, and you see this is the energy input, and that's minus the thrust, or the work done by the thrust on the surface, the effective thrust. If that term's positive, then we have an increase, continual increase in the phase velocity. That's equivalent to downshifting. I'll parameterize these terms in the next spot. It's dW dt is the work done either by the wind pressures or by braking. And then to a certain order, which is a very useful order, which is described down here, a high order, we can write those two equations in this form, more familiar form. This is the energy density. That's the wind input, energy from the wind. That's the dissipation, average dissipation on the surface due to braking. And this term involves the dissipation and the term gamma, because both the momentum loss and the dissipation loss are involved here, and gamma implies a certain relationship between them. You see, these are terms which are responsible for those nonlinear effects which I described, and you'll understand in a moment where this comes from. If gamma is positive, then downshifting occurs. It's very easy to determine gamma, and I haven't defined it yet, but I will now. And here's a picture of a wave, and you see energies flowing through the top of the jet here, and as I described before, in momentum. And it's easy to calculate the parameterized the loss of energy in a single breaking event in terms of the volume. It should be 1V here. The volume of water that went into the breaker. And the same for momentum. Each one is hard to calculate, but you see I have a relationship between momentum and energy loss here. And here's the parameter gamma, which has this definition. And gamma is positive in the case of breakers. It's always positive. It has a value of about a half. It's because of that there's an excess of momentum loss compared to energy loss. In a normal transfer between waves, and if it were conservative, the relationship dm is dE over c would be exactly followed. But in this case, depends on what happens at the breaker. And it's because of that excess of momentum loss that gamma is positive, that waves downshift. If gamma happened to be negative, waves would upshift, which means we would never have waves on the ocean surface. The only reason we can put a lot of energy in waves is they get longer. They get longer and they get steeper, so forth. And we've done spectral calculations of wave evolution in which we put these work on the surface and showed that if gamma is negative, you get down, you get upshifting. It works. So it is the breaker, and it is the momentum and energy losses occurring in the breaker that determine the direction in which the frequency, the energy is flowing, in this case the lower frequencies. And with these results, we can calculate those Fetch laws. In fact, when I showed you the Fetch laws, there were some solid lines on the figure. Those are from calculations based on a very simple theory, these relations which I showed you at the end, without the modulation terms. Finally, before I show you the animation, it's interesting that if I can combine the energy equation and the momentum equation and introduce the complex variable A, which is AE to the I, that should be I theta. And this is nothing but, on the left-hand side, the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. The right-hand side are the terms that are derived from the surface effects. But the interesting thing about this equation which we've derived is it's valid for all x and p's. It wasn't obtained as a result of a perturbation analysis. I mean, the nonlinear Schrodinger equation for wave evolution depends on time scaling, and it's based on a perturbation analysis, so it's only valid around certain values of k0. In this derivation from Hamilton's principle, it's generally valid. And you see in the long time when you turn this on, you get downshifting when gamma is positive. This is the form those terms take. I like the other two equations. They have more physical meaning, but same equation. Okay, now can I show you the simulation? It's very interesting to understand more about what happens when splash occurs. Now we have to turn this back on. It's on. So can you get me? It's red, is it? It was on then. Oh, no, no. No, I think it.
It's warming up.
Oh, I thought it was on.
There you go.
Okay, so I have to. Okay. So now, in order to understand the consequences of breaking, and there are many reasons to be interested in that, and this is where turbulence is produced in the water during splashing. The process is very complicated. It involves the jet hitting, ricocheting from the surface several times. It involves the region between the jet and the full wave collapsing, creating, you'll see right away there's a big circulation there, creating strong vorticity in the water and very interesting pattern. And in order to simulate that, we're using a gridless calculation called smooth particle hydrodynamics, which some of you may have heard of. The fluid is slightly compressible, so in some of these figures, you'll see sound waves emitted by jet splashing, which is a nice bonus if you're interested in underwater sound. This work has been done just during this year, and we're still involved in it. The pictures are very fascinating. And we have, that's good. Now, in this picture, this is to warm you up. This is a slug of fluid hitting an interface and let it go. And now can I see the one coming in at an inclined angle? Now the jet is hitting the surface at an angle, and here you'll see some details. This is not an animation. You'll see some details of what happens, and I chose this because the two fluids have different colors. You see the jet doesn't penetrate into the surface. And this is very surprising, because I showed you a picture in the beginning I pointed to this smooth surface and splash in front. Now, I always thought the water was going underneath and pushing the water up in front. Doesn't do that at all. It spreads out on the surface just as that jet entering does. Those of you who are familiar with that problem know the water comes right back up to the surface. And so until it closes, and then you begin to get mixing. So it's very difficult to know how mixing occurs so far. But you do form this splash up, which we can see in the radar, and you can see so visible in pictures. Can I have the next? In the next animation, this is really an animation, we have created this wave from the past, but I didn't show you the whole process. And the colors are just colors, tracers, to show you how mixing occurs. So let it go. It's going to climb the wall. You see it again up at the top. Not it backwards. This is an inviscid Euler equation calculation, except for whatever viscosity is in the numerics. There's no surface tension here. By the way, that's not so easy to do. We know how to do it, but it's not so easy. Nobody's done smooth particle hydrodynamics. We know how to do that. Okay. Yeah, I know. We know how to do it, but that's for the future. Yeah, I mean, to get all the details takes a long time here. In principle, this method can be used for arbitrary densities, 2D. So, which one is this? Okay, now pressure. And you see the code is blue is low pressure and the red is the highest through the hydrostatic effect. So you can, stop. Do you see the spherical waves generated at impact? See them? Those are acoustic waves. What's the last one? There appear in the water, you can just see it vaguely here, but I think you can see it on some other plots, this kind of mushroom formation which you get when you have intrusion that's associated with intrusion. That is a kind of doublet flow which appears. Oh yeah, well you can show the curl. Blue is vorticity, clockwise vorticity, and that's where the vorticity is created when this cavity collapses. There it is. There's the eddy in the water. you've got some counter, this is the dipole formation, which saw better, I think, in the first picture. You have to sit and watch these. Maybe you can turn this off, I guess. And finally, I'll just show you a dam break. Look at all the mixing that's occurred. Colors are getting mixed up. That's good. Well, thank you, Srini. Thank you all. Yes. Yes, and we can introduce air. I mean, we can vary the density. In fact, we've now already done some calculations on two-layer fluids. But it's possible to have any distribution of density in these. That's the beautiful thing about this simulation technique. We can use any sound speed variation. It's a Lagrangian technique, so it goes with the particles. And any density variation. But it's a lot of work. And there are about 10,000 particles in these simulations. Yeah, I know. I'll talk to you about it. Yeah. Let me just say this is not news. This has been up for a long time. Mike, long before Mike did that work. I don't think that's the real story, but that's another thing. Yeah, but he does one. I was asked that. Yes, it's possible. We haven't done it. In order to put surface tension in, we have to put particles above. In this calculation, we have only particles below. And I've been pushing to put particles above for various reasons. This is a very difficult. I see Daryl's nodding because people at Los Alamos have done some very good basic work on the smooth particle hydrodynamics. They know a lot about the pitfalls. There are a lot of pitfalls in it. And we've discovered them all and are trying to overcome them. And it was originally developed by a mathematician in Australia, Monash. No, not
Monash.
No, the university. It wasn't Monash. Monash. Yeah, named John Monahan. Actually, somebody preceded him named Lucy. But he used it to calculate very complicated astrophysical problems. The nice thing is you can vary the flow, like we just heard, the temperatures, densities of the flows. Done it, very complicated problems. And you can put transport into it. We haven't done that. And then he started using it for, people have used it occasionally for just recently for free surface problems. Are not easy. There are lots of problems with it. He's only done shallow water. We're doing deep water. And but it has a lot of potential. I like it for the reason that you can vary the stratified fluid. You can study the effects of air entrainment. Not so easy to calculate the air entrainment and so forth. And the equations, there's no work to upgrade it to 3D. The mathematics is the same. But computational needs. To prevent what?
Thank you.
I haven't thought about that. I mean, you mean wave breaker? You mean wave, breakwaters or? Good luck. I mean, there's a lot of energy in that wave. It's globally distributed. I mean, good luck. Yeah. You know, my interest, I mean, we are interested in the small wind waves, too. They're very important for remote sensing. And that's a different story, a very different story, the small waves. But I'm interested in the dynamics of waves out there in the ocean. As you saw, you got a tip of the picture. It's complicated, and nonlinear effects are very important. That's kind of a new realization. And I'm just trying to understand that. And in the open ocean, you're not going to affect anything, you know. You mean the big one in the front? I by the way, you can calculate on a fine enough scale. Usual wave calculations that are used by weather bureaus have a very large, poor resolution. So you can't get effects of small variations in quantities. You'll never find the dynamics that I discussed here. But I have been working on extreme wave problem. And it arises. It's fantastic. Let me just say that. I didn't begin to discuss it. But the equations I put up can be used to show how instabilities arise. They're not instabilities in the sense you've been talking about, but spikes begin to arise and get pulled up, and you get very large concentrations of wave energy from these nonlinear conservation laws. It's very interesting. Yes. In fact, if you look at them with your eye, they're white already. So there's aeration in the jets and so forth. But really, I don't think that affects the big picture here, because the same mass of water with the same velocity hits the surface and so forth. Yeah. You mean in the simulation? No. No, I mean, we've done many calculations by exact nonlinear calculations. So let me say, I already said that the strength of the jet varies. It depends on phasing of things. Sometimes the shape of the jet changes a little. But the general picture is as I described it. Of course, there's some range of energy and momentum flux in these waves. It's not a fixed quantity, it's average, some average over time. By the way, I mean, we deduce those things from ocean data, not from in a certain way. But they tend to agree with the picture I showed you. If I go into the little picture, I can rationalize the ocean data. Yeah. I don't think we've done that, but that's a wall. So if they're identical, you mean non-identical. Oh, I see. You're telling me that. Yeah. No. Yeah. Oh, we generate vorticity here. Oh, whenever you have two surfaces touch where the velocities are not are different in parallel to the interface, you generate vorticity. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, oh, sure. And when you see when that jet comes down, at the moment it touches, I have a circulation inside. I can compute it numerically, and that gets put into the water through the continuous sealing of the air-water interface.
Mm-hmm.
So what your statement was that... you mean the spectra that are... The spectra. I don't believe any of that. Let me tell you something. You can measure the spectrum very easily with a pole that moves up and down. And most spectra you'll see in books are from a pole that moves up and down. But independent of the direction from which the wave comes, it will influence the pole. So I think that in each direction you have waves. You have a number of wave systems in the ocean which are traveling in different directions, and each one of them is much narrower than the spectrum that's observed with the pole. And the basis, for instance, you're talking about Zakharov's theory. I mean, Zakharov says, I produce omega to the minus 4, which is the drop-off in the energetic part of the spectrum. First of all, Zakharov is treating a soup of waves, isotropic waves. I don't understand that. Yes, I don't understand. So I don't understand. That has very little relation to wind waves, which are directional. And that's becoming more and more evident as we use radars. It's very difficult to observe the directionality of waves with buoys. They do, like Biscuit's buoy, which is the most common directional buoy, does a horrible job. Hasn't got enough degrees of freedom. Terrible job. You need many degrees of freedom to describe directional spectra, and radars are pretty good at that. And it's coming out that, you know, the waves are the directional distributions are coming out that confirm what I've been telling you, that I think the individual spectra... In my wind wave tank, for instance, the spectra drops off not like omega to the minus fourth, even at the highest wind speed. When I have gravity waves, wind waves, omega to the minus 9 or minus 10. When you add those systems together, they work like omega to the minus 4, something like that. We don't know as much as people think and have thought. Let me just say that. Whether I'm right or not, a lot of what we know is true in every field. A lot of what we know about these things, what's stated in books, is probably not scientifically correct yet. So. Yeah. Well, that's it. That's it. The circulation is the interval of the vorticity, right? So that vorticity appears, and I showed it to you, the blue evolving blob came from the collapse of that region.
Yeah.
Now think about it. Yeah. Well, you see it in the numerics.
Okay. I think,
thank you for your patience and interest.
Thank you.